You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, June 23rd, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, everybody.
We're recording a little bit early. We're into the lead up to the Amazing meeting, so we have to get some shows done early, which is why we're recording on a Monday instead of our usual Wednesday.
And my heart stood still.
So this weekend, guys, I saw George Robb perform.
How was it?
It was awesome. He was great.
Did he play music?
He did. He played music.
Oh, excellent.
It's actually the first time I've seen him in the role of a drummer in a band, you know?
Josh mentioned that.
Yeah, he's always playing the guitar and singing, you know, on most of his shows, but this time he was in a band.
So how is he, Steve?
Oh, he is an awesome drummer.
I don't doubt it.
Wow, I did not know that he was such a good drummer. Josh was saying that you were having a fun conversation with him. I guess you were picking his brain and stuff. I didn't know that drumming is like his main shtick. I mean, that's what I was about to say.
Yeah. That's like what he's a drummer paid for.
Yeah, that's exactly. So, I mean, I did a little drumming, so I know enough to at least recognize good drumming when I see it.
How does he hold his stick, Steve?
He did both. I noticed he did the match and, you know, and the traditional. He sort of switched back and forth. It wasn't one of his usual band. He made a new band just for this gig. It's called the Blue Turtles, and it's a tribute band to Sting. And the middle section of the concert, they did the entire album, The Dream of the Blue Turtles.
Wow.
So bummed I missed it.
Came out in 1985. Well, they're going to have an encore July 25th.
I'll be there.
Oh, ooh.
Sweet.
Okay, here are all the details. The next showing will be on July 25th. That's a Friday at the TD Bank Community Stage Arts Quest Center at Steel Stacks, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And again, we'll have the link for the show in the show notes. I forgot how effing good that album is.
Blue Turtles is like a sex position, right?
Could be. It's quite possible.
The bass player was good?
Oh, the bass player was epic. So he pulled a couple of his band members from the Philadelphia Funk Authority. So, his bass player was extremely good. He had a saxophonist who was like a professor of the saxophone. I mean, just like a music professor. Very incredible. His good friend Slough was lead guitar and singing. He had, you know, a keyboardist and a couple of backup singers, including his girlfriend Kira was one of the backup singers.
Slough has an incredible voice. I bought one of his albums, and he's smooth as hell, man.
He pulled off Sting. You know, it wasn't Sting, but he pulled off Sting. He did a very good job. If you haven't listened to the album, The Dream of the Blue Turtles, 1985, but it's still relevant today. Totally relevant. It's a great album. It's like a fusion, you know, rock, jazz, lots of instrumental performances. Very, very good. You listen to it and you realize how crappy a lot of the pop music is, you know.
Thank you. Yes.
It's just, Sting at his best, I think.
I'm glad to hear that George kicked ass again.
Yeah.
He went right off of Dune and went right into making that album.
Yeah. Right.
It's good to hear.
I will kill him.
All right, Rebecca, what's special about this day in history?
So much, Steve. I'm so glad you asked. Most importantly, though, today, June 28th, in 1895, on June 28th, the Court of Private Land Claims ruled that James Revis's claim to the Barony of Arizona is wholly fictitious and fraudulent. Now, this is an immense story that I had never heard of before I started looking into interesting things that happened today. And I basically spent several hours reading this ridiculous story of this ridiculous man's life. So James Revis attempted to become basically the Baron of Arizona, what would have been the third Baron of Arizona, according to his mythology that he made up.
Yeah, but him and his partner Butthead.
Yes. Revis and Butthead. That's very good. Yeah, Rutthead would have been funnier.
Rutthead. I was thinking about Rutthead, but it's just Rutthead.
You should have gone with that.
He also has epic mutton chops. See?
Yeah, there's a picture of him on his Wikipedia page, and he is quite the looker. Revis took advantage of this time in American history when there was a lot of, there were a lot of problems figuring out land ownership because of the expanding U.S. territory, coming into contact with previous Spanish territory. And so there were a lot of claims being made to land that was pretty suspicious, and a lot of corrupt courts that were ruling on whether or not these claims were legitimate. So Rivas is this guy who was at one point a Confederate soldier who spent his time during the Civil War forging notes to go home. Like, he found he was really good at forging documents to take leave. When he realized that the Confederates were losing, he switched to the Union and continued forging notes, but they eventually figured it out and booted him. He then went traveling around, like to Brazil and random places. Eventually, he became a real estate agent, and he found out about all of these sketchy deals that were going down concerning land ownership. Through a number of wacky chance meetings and such, he eventually got his hands on a potential deed for a huge portion of Arizona, over 18,000 square miles, roughly the size of Delaware. And he went about forging hundreds of documents in order to grab this land for himself. And not only forging documents, but creating people out of whole cloth, making up this legacy of Spanish royalty, and trying to pass it off as though, through a series of weird situations, he had legally obtained this this land. He moved in and told everybody on this land that they had to get out or start paying him rent, basically. A lot of people fell for it. He managed to get a silver mine to pay him off thousands of dollars. And he even started dealing with the railroad and making thousands of dollars working out these deals with them, where he agreed to let them build through his land. A lot of people in the area got frustrated at that point and just left. Like, they just abandoned their homes because they figured this guy was going to come in and sue them and kick them out. But eventually, as I began with this day in history, eventually the U.S. government said no, that he was full of shit, basically. But then he kept trying. He made up another person who he said was the sole heiress of this land, probably just some orphan he found in Mexico somewhere, that he coached into being this quote-unquote baroness. He even sent her to this finishing school to make her seem like a socialite. And so then he married her, and he claimed that the land was his because of that. That, too, was thrown out. Eventually, even though he ended up making a lot of money out of his various scams, he eventually ended up losing it all and dying a pauper. Oh, in Colorado. James Rivas. That's only a little bit of the story. His Wikipedia page is a book. There's a film in 1950 called The Baron of Arizona, which you can watch to get an idea of what he did. And there have been, I think, several long articles and books written about him, because he was a very interesting character.
Yeah, it's amazing how far he got. I mean, it partly unraveled because he sued the United States government for money for taking away his land. And that's when they really launched into the criminal investigation that really brought everything down.
Yeah.
But also, some of the people who were defending him did so on the basis that no one person could have forged hundreds of documents and invented this whole story.
The sheer audacity of his crime is what he had going in his favor. And yeah, he had supporters like Robert G. Ingersoll, I noticed, according to his Wikipedia page. Like, he tricked some very rich and powerful people into siding with him, which then, you know, encourages other rich and powerful people to side with him. And so, yeah, it was really just an amazing scam.
But some people he promised, like, hey, when the whole deal goes through, you know, I'll give you $20,000, you know, so that came out as well. Some people that he essentially bribed. All right, thanks, Rebecca. All right, Bob, you're going to start off the news items. You were almost giddy when you were talking about this to me, the microarchitecture design. Tell us about that.
I never get giddy. This is so awesome. So material scientists have designed and tested a micro-lattice metamaterial that's 100 times stiffer than its closest competition, which is kind of stiff, and it could actually revolutionize entire industries.
Bob, you're saying it has stiff competition?
Yes. Oh, boy, you really went there?
Well, just sitting there. Come on.
And it could revolutionize entire industries, specifically ones that would benefit, and that's a lot of them, from ultra-lightweight, ultra-strong materials. And 100 times really doesn't really do it much justice, because that's more of the cutting-edge stuff that some of the labs have produced that haven't really been produced in any commercial way. So now, lattices in this context, you could think of as trusses and girders that they can be used for structural elements, like load-bearing elements. So I've been trying to think of a way to visualize this. You could always just Google it, and you'll see what this thing looks like. But imagine a bunch of letter X's joined at their tips, back-to-back, joined at their tips and at their midsections in some kind of complex three-dimensional shape. But this latest work was done by teams at MIT and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories, and I think they really have something awesome here. I know it's obvious that materials typically get weaker as they get less dense, right? It's pretty obvious. You take a cane and you start removing mass. Pretty soon you're going to fall flat on your face. Just can't support the weight anymore. But you can actually make something lightweight, very lightweight even, while maintaining extraordinary stiffness and strength. And that's been done to a large degree by just grabbing the low-hanging fruit, I guess. The easy ways to accomplish that have already been done. So in order to make a material inhabit the extreme ends of the strength and weight spectra, you've got to work really hard. I think this is what these guys have done. This recent design breakthroughs pretty much started initially with a mathematically determined shape that met those requirements to maximize stiffness and minimize weight. But if that wasn't hard enough, it took another 10 years to turn that geometric structure into a 3D printed object. I mean, 10 years, I've been trying to find out, what has taken so long. You would think once you have, the mathematical object, you could then fairly quickly do this. Part of it might be maybe the technology wasn't up to the job. But it really was worth the wait, though, because this micro-architected, micro-lattice metamaterial, it's truly a marvel of engineering. They created this using a special projection micro-stereolithography 3D printer, and this is used for extremely small-scale building of objects and prototypes. They use a UV laser to shine into a tank of a photosensitive material to build this up layer by layer. And then once you have that made, what you could do is you could then coat the outside with another material. And then once that's solidified, you just dissolve. You could use thermal energy to dissolve the interior. So basically you end up with these hollow tube lattices that are incredibly strong. So what they did, once this was done, they did test using a range of materials like polymers, metals, and ceramics. And they tested all of them, and all of them displayed strength that was even beyond what their expectations were for it. So a really good comparison for this kind of thing is you'd have to consider something called an aerogel. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of that. It's really this amazing glass foam substance that what they do is they take a gel and they have all of its liquid removed and replaced with a gas. So when that's done, what you're left with is this weird porous, insanely lightweight substance that people call frozen smoke. I mean, it literally looks like frozen smoke. It's just so sparse and porous. It doesn't look substantial at all. But the weird thing is that it seems it's unusually strong for its weight. Incredibly strong. If you took a piece of solid rubber that had the same dimensions, it has roughly a similar strength, which is pretty amazing considering, like, you imagine smoke being as strong as rubber. I mean, pretty amazing.
Bob, what would they use this stuff for?
With these little structural materials, you could apply to, and Jay, think about it, cars, aerospace, where weight and strength are key. Those are just two huge, huge applications that I see. As awesome as aerogel is, this stuff is 10,000 times stiffer. That's four orders of magnitude stiffer than aerogel, which is amazing. So the reason there's such a huge difference is because aerogel is kind of like random. The shapes just kind of, appear organically, but this is micro-architected. It's a metamaterial. So it's designed specifically to take lots of load. So just speculating from that, you could obviously create a substance as dense as aerogel, but 10,000 times stronger.
So this stuff is 10,000 times stiffer and it can take a huge load?
Better.
I'm trying over here. Bob, this is sounding like the material that we need to build the space elevator.
No, this resists compression. The elevator needs cables that have tensile strength. They're totally different.
Yeah, I think we got to go with the graphene there, Jay. So like I said, the applications are pretty much endless. Any industry at all that requires lightweight materials and strength. I mean, there's tons of them. But the obvious ones, like I said, are the cars. Can you imagine cars? What would a car weigh if it was made, significantly of this material? I mean, could you potentially have a car that's like 8%, 10% of the weight of a regular car? I mean, can you imagine? And also planes and satellites and spaceships and all that would greatly benefit, because we know it costs about, what, $250 billion just to send a damn pound of anything into space.
Yeah, I guess that really the only remaining question is, how is it going to scale up? Which is actually a really big question. Is it going to be, are you going to be able to actually like build a million cars out of this stuff? Or is it, if it's too expensive and slow a process, it may be a great for specific high-end applications, but NASA may end up using it, but it wouldn't necessarily be changing the auto industry,
Yeah, that's possible, but I tend to doubt it.
As long as they don't make a clear airplane with this stuff, I'm fine.
An invisible airplane?
Yeah.
Like a Wonder Woman plane?
Yeah, but
that'd be amazing.
I mean, that'd be cool in one regard, but imagine being on the plane. That'd be pretty scary.
Yeah, it'd be amazing.
Yeah. Use the lavatory.
Unless you're afraid of heights, it'd be really scary.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, Jay, you're going to tell us about a massive underground ocean, quote-unquote ocean, that was recently discovered.
Did you guys know that there's water in them thar mantles?
Mm-hmm.
To be more accurate, there's water below the upper mantle and above the lower mantle, between 255 to 410 miles down, or 410 to 660 kilometers down.
So the mid-mantle is what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't think anything is labeled mid-mantle.
Yeah, I know. I just pulled that out of my butt.
It's estimated.
Call it the mezzanine.
It's estimated that there's three times the Earth's oceans of water down there, and it's waiting there for us, Bob. Did that sound creepy?
So Jake, we can just go swimming in this water?
No, absolutely not. There is a mineral called ringwoodite. It's a rare mineral, and it forms from olivine under extremely high pressure and temperature. And this is exactly what is found in the mantle's transition zone. I guess that's what you call the middle mantle, is this transition zone. So what's happening here is scientists believe that the ringwoodite can, in its molecular structure, contain hydrogen ions. And this is a bonded oxygen and hydrogen atom, right? So it's not water. It's a bonding of oxygen and hydrogen that just forms, like, I guess it's part of this mineral. And the molecules are not in liquid or vapor form, which means that this is really a misleading title if you think about it, because they didn't really find, like, it's not like a huge ocean three times the size of all the Earth's oceans down there. It's mostly this mineral that's down there with some, loose water in between, in the tiny little cracks and crevices that are down there.
But the water itself, the volume of that water is estimated to be three times the Earth's oceans. It's just, bound up in this ringwoodite.
Right, exactly.
So it never sees the light of day, per se. It never comes to the surface. It never mingles with the ocean that we're used to.
That's not necessarily true, Ev, because what they think is that because of this new information, they are questioning where the oceans come from. That's really, one of the things that this information helps us figure out. And they think that the ocean not only came from that area now, but that because the ocean that's on the surface of the planet has remained constant in its volume, that the water is being fed and there's kind of an equilibrium going on between our top of, surface ocean and then this under ocean, which I think is an incredible idea, being that, the leading thing up until now, or at least one of the leading theories, has been that the water came from comets crashing into an early Earth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it's really – because this has been one of the debates, after the Earth, like the crust solidified, did the oceans rained down by mainly, were they fed by comets over millions of years, or did the water mainly bubble up from beneath the surface from water that was deposited from earlier impacts, you know? So this, the fact that there's so much water down there, you could say that that supports the bubbling up from below hypothesis, you know, over the raining down in comets hypothesis, but sure, both are at least partly true.
Now, you know? Do any of you guys remember going to Disney World and they had something in Epcot Center
yes.
with that water thing? It was like kind of like a water zoo. And there was a video that mm-hmm. they played that showed like
the
Earth's
called an aquarium.
Yeah, but it really wasn't an
like
aquarium.
A water zoo.
A water zoo, yeah.
A water zoo.
I didn't want to call it an
behind
aquarium.
Behind the cage there.
I think of an aquarium more like above ground and everything. This was different. It was weird. But anyway, they had a video there that showed the Earth's atmosphere kind of condensing, and then the video makes you think that it just rained for a long time, and that's where the oceans came from. Do you guys remember that video?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess that's not that that's wrong, or maybe that's another theory, but, you know, it's really not a leading theory anymore. So Stephen Jacobson of Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, which is found in the United States, and his team used 2,000 seismometers. They're big. To analyze the seismic waves of over 500 earthquakes. So these earthquakes, or you know, think of it like it as a giant shock wave, and it can move all the way down to the Earth's core, and it can be detected on the surface. That's what they use the instruments for. So Jacobson says that the Earth can ring like a bell, which I thought was such a cool way of describing what happens after an earthquake, that the Earth can ring like a bell for days. And they measure the speed of the shock waves as they travel through the different layers. And, you know, what they did was, they theorized that one of the layers would be this mineral, ringwoodite. And he created some ringwoodite in a lab, tested how fast sound would travel through it under pressure and heat, you know, matching what would be at the zone that he thinks it existed in. And he was right. His predictions were correct. That's science at work, guys. Very good example of, you know, someone coming up with a theory that he tested out. Now, the sound waves can't travel through liquid water or, you know, sweaty rocks, or that's the way they're kind of describing this ringwoodite as, like, these minerals that have a sweaty layer of water around them. The sound waves can't travel that fast through that type of substrate, and they were able to determine that, yes, indeed, it is there. It is at this particular depth, and now we have pretty damn solid evidence that not only is that stuff there, but how much of it is there and how much water is down there. So they found out quite a bit of information from doing these readings. He also said that we should be grateful for this deep reservoir. If it wasn't there, it would be on the surface of the Earth, and mountaintops would be the only land poking out. Wow. That's like...
Have the creationists come along yet and stake claim to this as a proof of the Great Flood of way back when?
I haven't heard anything about that yet, Ev, but this is a relatively new news item, so we got to
give him any ideas of
it. Oh, shoot.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was odd to think about it that way, that... You know, if it weren't for this rock, then all of that water would be on the surface. I don't know if that's true. That's interesting. The other thing, you know, the other way to think about it, if that reservoir weren't there, our oceans may have slowly gone away over the last 4 billion years.
Ah.
You know, yeah, so the oceans are sort of being dragged underneath the crust, you know, at subduction zones. And the question, that has been a question, well, what's replenishing the oceans? Assuming they're at some sort of steady state. I mean, I've heard scientists, you know, report that the oceans are going away, you know, in 100 million years, they'll be gone, which makes no sense, you know, that they've been here for 4.5 billion years and then 100 million years are going to be gone. That doesn't make any sense. But it makes more sense that, you know, that, again, the water is at equilibrium. Part of it's being dragged down, but some of it's got to be bubbling up from beneath. And now there's a reservoir to show that can happen. So it's interesting. Ooh.
What if we find out on Mars there's this subterranean ocean,
could
you
be.
Know, underneath that would be fascinating.
Submartian yeah. ocean. Hello.
Okay, Bob. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Yeah, that was a really cool item. I thought that was very interesting. So, guys, on my blog, Neurologica, I'm in the middle of a debate with a 9/11 truther. Well,
no, you're not. You're
generously.
You're at the end of the debate. It should end right now. Where do we go from here?
Bob
really?
Is calling an end to it.
you're the judge. You're coming in. You're ending the fight.
He's tapping out. That's you can't TKO. Really technical. Hear it, but he's tapping out.
Bob, is this guy pissing you off? Like, what's going on?
No, kind of. The paucity of evidence pissed me off. He really had no real evidence to lay down on the table, and Steve just demolished it.
So this is Michael Fullerton. He actually contacted me, challenged me to a live debate on the collapse of the Twin Towers. So I said, yeah, let's do it in writing, you know, because
smart.
That kind of debate is not really good for, it's very technical, you know, and, or at least I was expecting it to be. And so, you know, for a live debate, it's hard because you end up with a he said, she said situation. And, you know, this way in a blog, you can have links and check your references and you could really work over the details. And it's just much a better venue for this subject matter. So he wrote the first salvo and I wrote my reply this week and I did offer him, you know, one round of rebuttals as well. So he'll get to make a rebuttal, then I'll get the final rebuttal and then it'll be over. So, I mean, obviously this is old ground, but it is interesting to see how people, you know, the kinds of, this is almost like a name that logical fallacy segment. It's like, well, what mental errors is he committing here? His argument is basically this, that, and as Bob said, he doesn't really put forward much information. He's trying rather to rig the game rather than to make a case. So he believes that the Twin Towers were brought down by controlled demolition. And he doesn't really offer any evidence in favor of controlled demolition or against the standard hypothesis, which is I'm supporting, which is that the steel supports at the levels of impact failed. And once they did, you know, collapse was inevitable.
It's more than a hypothesis, I would say.
Yeah, it's pretty well established at this point. I mean, all the evidence supports that position. But he's, you know, to me, it sounds like he's trying to rig the game and shift the burden of evidence. So he's saying that, first of all, he claims that the NIST, you know, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, and no one has essentially offered any evidence to support the standard version of events about how the towers fell, and that the evidence supports a controlled demolition because the way the towers fell looked like a controlled demolition.
Oh, well. QED. Oh,
what more evidence do you need?
That's really his argument. And so you might ask, well, how did they look like a controlled demolition? What criteria of looking like a controlled demolition?
Symmetrical-ish.
It's yeah, like, so he saw it on TV, Steve, well, that, and it looked like things he's seen on
Evan,
TV.
No. YouTube. Anyway.
Shoot, my bad.
Yeah, get it right. Anyway, so... Yeah, so Bob is what Bob said. One of the criteria was because it fell symmetrically, and the other was that it fell rapidly. But of course, he doesn't operationally define either of those criteria. He doesn't give any parameters, which is why it fell not perfectly symmetrical, just symmetrical-ish. But of course, if you look at a picture, like there's a really good picture taken from below of the South Tower at the moment that collapse initiated. And mm-hmm. the upper part of the tower is leaning over significantly.
Optical illusion.
It's not, I mean, you could see, no, it's not an optical illusion. I mean, maybe at this angle, it might be the best angle for seeing exactly how much it's leaning over, but it's not symmetrical. What it looks like is what NIST said, which was, if you imagine, you know, obviously the towers were, you know, rectangular. So they have four sides and the plane that, you know, that crashed into each tower took out a lot of the supports on the side of the building that it hit. Did, you know, in one of the towers, there was some damage to the core columns and the other tower, it wasn't that much damage to the core column. But then the fires burned, weakening the floors, weakening the outer supports. You know, got hot enough not to melt the steel, but to weaken their integrity so that they couldn't bear the load. And you could see the floor sagging. There are multiple videos and pictures of the towers. You could see the floor sagging. And when the floor sagged, they pulled in the outer columns. And you can see that happening. You could see the pulling in of the outer columns and the sagging of the floor. So, and then at that point, one side, one of the four outer walls failed. And when that happened, the tower tilted to that side, right? As you could imagine. And then once that happened, the load got redistributed to all the other supports, which they immediately failed. And then once that happened, the upper section of the tower was in near free fall. And by the time it hit the floor below it, there was so much momentum behind that upper part of the tower, which now is completely unsupported, that it exceeded the load bearing capacity of the floors below it by an order of magnitude. And there was actually linked to a paper which showed that the cushioning effect, you know how they talk about, well, why was the tower fall so quickly? It was whatever, quote unquote, near free fall. It's definitely less than free fall, which Michael admits it was less than free fall, but he just, in a very vague and non-specific way, so it just was too fast to have been, you know, due to the structural failure. It must have been a controlled demolition. But in fact, there's multiple analyses showing that, no, that's about how fast it should have fallen. I mean, the cushioning would have been minimal, 6%. It only would have slowed the descent of the tower by about 6% from free fall, which is not really that perceptible to the naked eye.
Right.
You know, only if you can compare it to debris actually in free fall, you could see they're falling a little bit slower than free fall. So it all fits. So what Michael apparently would have you believe is that a jet crashed into each tower, took out some of the outer supports. They were loaded with jet fuel. They were accelerating into the tower. They started fires, which burned, you know, over the course of an hour or two, depending on the tower. There was sagging and pulling into the walls, evidence that the steel supports were failing. And right at that moment, at that level, somebody detonated a controlled demolition and initiated the collapse of the tower.
And somehow they didn't go off prematurely because of all the hellish inferno that they were engulfed in. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, they didn't go off prematurely.
They didn't leave any telltale seismic events that would be easily heard, taped, and recorded.
Yeah, so they were silent, invisible, and completely hidden controlled demolitions. There was no evidence of actual explosions. No one heard any actual explosions. This was a highly recorded event and witnessed event, and there's no evidence of controlled demolition. So what he's using is the most non-specific features, that the towers fell roughly straight and roughly quickly, to say that it was therefore a controlled demolition, because that looks like a controlled demolition, even though all of the specific features of a controlled demolition are missing. So the analogy I made when I wrote my first rebuttal was, that's like a doctor saying, you have a fever. That means you have this rare tropical infection, even though you have none of the other signs or symptoms of this rare tropical infection, because you have a fever, and a fever is a sign of an infection, right? Never mind that it could also be a symptom of all these far more common things. So we'll see how he responds. You know, it seems like I suspect he's going to want to expand the debate, and I'm not sure how he's going to counter the specific bits of evidence that I provided. We'll see. It's always interesting to see how people respond when confronted with hard evidence, which is why I find this fascinating. It's the psychological aspects of such a one-sided, in my opinion, debate, and how is he going to wrap his head around this.
Steve, what do you think about providing the platform for this gentleman, Michael Fullerton, to, you know, espouse his non-scientific opinions on these matters?
Yeah, you know, some people, you know, this again went up on our Facebook page, and there's a lot of comments, more there than on my blog, but people asking, so what's the point of all this? Why are we beating this dead horse? And there are two points to it. There are still a lot of people who will hear the claims of a 9/11 truther and not have the detailed information accessible in order to counter it. So there are lots of people who I think are on the fence or just uninformed about this. So putting it down in a very easily accessible format, here's the links, here's the points, you know, is always valuable. Again, you know, yes, we are going to have to beat these dead horses. Get over it. The other part is the critical thinking aspect of it, is pointing out that, so the major malfunction in Michael's argument is that he is relying upon non-specific, open-ended criteria. That's a very important lesson in critical thinking, because we all do that frequently. I frequently encounter people making that kind of mental error, you know, in more subtle forms, you know, in the defense of more reasonable positions. But this is an example of that particular lack of critical thinking. You know, you have, especially the open-ended criteria, you know, that we sort of give ourselves a very easy task. You know, we like what he's doing, it looks like a controlled demolition, but it doesn't have any parameters on those criteria at all. So keep, you know, that's something to keep an eye out in your own reasoning. Like, especially like, you know, the most common scenario in which I encounter this is just in political discussions, you know, where people generally are defending an ideological position. This is a very common way in which they, you know, people will defend a position regardless of what the facts are, just by allowing completely open-ended criteria. And we see this a lot in pseudoscience. Pseudoscientists will do this as well. It's also partly the Texas sharpshooter fallacy, you know, where you decide on the criteria after you have the evidence, as opposed to before, you know.
Right. Shoot the target, shoot the side of a building and then draw a bullseye.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you shot. Hey, I got it.
Exactly. So that's kind of what Michael's doing here too. Just, he's taking the evidence and saying this fits a controlled demolition, but he's just working backwards. This is not what you would predict from a controlled demolition. There aren't any specific features of a controlled demolition. He's just deciding after the fact that this, you know, and giving himself as much wiggle room as he needs, the symmetrical-ish way in which it fell. He thinks he's being rigorous and scientific, but clearly he isn't. So that's,
I think it's actually a good exercise. I hear what Evan is saying, but it doesn't really bother me because.
Oh no, I'm playing devil's advocate. Believe me, I think all of this is valuable, and I think there's a historical component to this that hasn't been raised. You know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when these sorts of myths, you know, tend to gain momentum, and you know, more people, especially those who weren't around at the time or born yet, have to go back and see that we'll have, you know, there's more that we have in writing to document and counter these arguments that the deniers are making, the better. So I think there's a historical component.
Yeah,
to all this.
Agree. That Daniel Loxton pointed out that part of the mission of the skeptical movement is to be the memory, the cultural memory for these sorts of things. We're the ones who will remember the details of this, you know, otherwise long forgotten issue, so that when it keeps resurfacing every generation, we'll be there to go, nope, been there. Here's the information. We have the references. We don't have to, you know, reinvent the wheel here, you know? All right, let's move on. Evan, apparently there's a lot of whooping cough going around.
A lot of whooping cough, and especially in certain states such as California. I'm going to read for you directly from the California Department of Public Health, their website, cdph.ca.gov. California is experiencing a whooping cough epidemic. They're calling it an epidemic. And this was from just a couple weeks ago. More than 800 new cases of pertussis have been reported in the last 2 weeks. 802 weeks. Ouch. The state has reached epidemic proportions. It was reported by Dr. Ron Chapman, director of the CDPH, and a state health officer. As of June 10th, there had been 3,400, roughly, cases of pertussis reported in 2014, more than were reported in all of 2013. So it's bad and getting worse. And again, over 800 new cases in just the past 2 weeks. Pertussis is cyclical and peaks every 3 to 5 years. The last peak in California occurred in 2010, so this was about the right time for another peak to come along. Obviously, infants too young to be fully immunized remain the most vulnerable to severe and fatal cases of pertussis. 2/3 of pertussis hospitalizations have been children 4 months or younger, and 2 infant deaths have been reported.
Yeah, it's very serious.
And why? Why is this happening? Well, I think there's a direct correlation to lack of people keeping up with their children's vaccination schedules, having, mm-hmm. you know, built up over the past, you know, decade or two.
Well, and also adults keeping up with their vaccination schedules. Like the interesting thing about pertussis is that it's not like your MMR shot. The pertussis vaccine is imperfect. It doesn't guarantee you're not going to get it, and it wears off after several years. Its efficacy, I should say, decreases as time goes on. So a lot of adults don't even realize that they should be getting their booster shot about every 5 years or so. I didn't know it until a couple years back when we started hosting pertussis vaccine clinics by a skeptic in the CDC. So I was, you know, we were helping a lot of adults at the time realize it, because I heard constantly from people like, oh no, I got vaccinated as a kid. And we're like, well, have you been vaccinated as an adult? Because if not, you're going to need to go back in.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing about that, Rebecca, is that even though those adults, you know, who haven't gotten their shots for this or their boosters, they may still carry it around. And although they're not directly suffering from it, they're more likely to give it off to people, infants and so forth, you know, who haven't been up to date on their schedule. So people, I guess, become carriers.
Yeah. And it's not generally, fatal in adults. But it is for infants, and a lot of people don't realize that. I think they think of whooping cough as, oh, just a bad cough. But whooping cough, if you don't, getting the vaccine helps reduce the symptoms, apparently, if you do actually get it, in addition to reducing your total risk of contracting it. But the symptoms of like pure whooping cough, it's coughing until you vomit, and like people break ribs coughing so hard with whooping cough. And like you said, it's killed 2 infants already in California. So it is a serious problem.
The other wrinkle to all this is, you know, that in the 1990s in the United States, we switched from the whole cell pertussis vaccine to the acellular pertussis vaccine. This was DTP
versus the DTaP.
Yeah, so
TDAP versus DTaP.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Or DTWP for the whole host cell pertussis. And the host cell was more effective than the acellular. So we went to a less effective vaccine in the 1990s, and this did have an impact. And the reason for that was concerns over the safety of the host cell pertussis vaccine, which really was based upon very flimsy evidence. You know, so it was, again, mainly due to fear-mongering over the host cell pertussis vaccine. Although there was some, very few cases, you know, there was some legitimacy there. But again, we sort of traded a more effective vaccine with a very slight, you know, risk of side effects for a presumably safer but less effective vaccine. And that's one that has the more rapidly waning protection. So that's partly why adults need to go get their boosters.
I was reading an article out of USA Today. They're interviewing a doctor on this subject, and he feels that the bacteria that causes whooping cough is probably mutating also in ways that makes it less susceptible.
Yep, that's
to the current vaccine.
That's another reason. But again, the current vaccine has less broad coverage. That's partly why. So we do need to, I think, research the next pertussis vaccine that's going to have, you know, a good safety profile and maybe be more effective, have a broader coverage, you know, longer lasting immunity.
Steve, I agree, but really isn't the short term solution to this, you know, more people getting vaccinated immediately?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That is the short term. Just get the vaccine and keep up with your boosters. That won't solve the evolving resistance problem, you know, the new strains emerging that aren't covered by the current vaccine. We have to keep up with the new strains.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's a yearly effort, but
no, not really. They're thinking of the flu. It's not really yearly, but I mean, this has just emerged in the last couple of years, whereas, you know, it's been the same strains for the last couple of decades.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's just a recent phenomenon. It's not like the flu. The flu is the yearly strains we got to keep up with, but this is different.
I thought they were slowly tweaking all vaccines as the years roll.
No. You're just thinking of the flu vaccine.
Yeah, true to our human nature, I'd really like to blame someone for this. And, you know, a couple names are popping.
Well, you can blame Jenny McCarthy if you want.
Yeah, I'd like to.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously more complex than just that. But the after the last outbreak in California, researchers did study what was going on in the different clusters of outbreaks. And what they found were parents who opted out entirely of getting their kids the pertussis vaccine, they tended to be in clusters. And what they found was that those clusters overlapped significantly with the clusters of outbreaks, to the point where if you were a parent who opted out of getting your child vaccinated for pertussis, you were much more likely to be within that cluster of pertussis outbreaks. So, and their conclusion was that, you know, we can lay a certain portion of this at the feet of the anti-vaccine movement.
Oh, yeah, I think there's no question about that. I agree. The evidence is showing that. Okay, well, we'll see. Well, the year's not over yet. We're only halfway done with the year. It's already a huge outbreak. So we'll keep tracking this as it goes on. Rebecca, this is an interesting news item about trophy wives, which apparently is a myth.
The trophy wife stereotype is the idea that women trade on their good looks, particularly young, poor, of a low social class, trade their good looks for a man who is in a higher social class, who maybe has money. And yeah, that's known as the trophy wife. And, Elizabeth McClintock at Notre Dame, she's a sociologist, she took a look at a huge database of information on couples. This data was mostly looked at couples who were in their early 20s who were either married, cohabiting, or dating a minimum of 3 months. 1,500 couples total, a little more than 1,500, roughly broken into chunks of 500. And each of these couples had been evaluated for a number of different aspects, particularly their attractiveness. There was like a team of judges who rated their looks, as well as their social status, their income, their how well put together they were. A lot of very relative traits that they still seem confident is worth noting and worth looking at, which is, I think, debatable. Apparently, the judges all had similar ratings. When two judges judged the same person, they tended to give them the same attractiveness ratings. So, I don't know, apparently they found that it was objective enough. And so McClintock took this data and she looked to see if there was any evidence within these couples of people trading status for beauty. And in the past, studies have been done on this that have mostly more or less seemed to find that it's true that women particularly trade their beauty for an increase in status. But McClintock points out in her paper a number of problems with these previous studies, particularly things like studies taking into account the woman's attractiveness but not the man's, and the man's social status but not the woman's, things like that. And what she found was that when you look at both partners' attractiveness and status, there's actually no real evidence of this so-called trophy wife stereotype. She found that there was much more evidence of matching, which is an alternate theory of dating, which says that it's more likely that somebody will find a partner who is about the same as them in terms of social status. And there are a number of different ways that she looked at partners partnering up and the criteria they use. And there are some that are very black and white, like us versus them, things like race and religion. But there are these other things that are on more of a graded scale where like one is better than another, like with income and beauty, you know. So yeah, she was particularly looking at those aspects. And yeah, what she found is that people were much more likely to date within their race, date within their religion, and also to date around the same level of attractiveness and around the same level of social status. And there are a number of reasons why she speculates that her study came to this conclusion compared to previous studies. One is she makes it, I think, pretty clear that hers is attempting to be more robust by looking at more aspects of each subject. But there were a few other things, like these couples were pretty young. So maybe in your 20s, there's more equilibrium amongst couples. But once you get much older, you might have such a higher social rank and such a lower attractiveness that you do feel that you can trade one for the other. Oh, one other thing she mentions that I thought was very interesting is that across all of the subjects, women tended to be rated as more attractive. And she mentions that maybe because of our sort of social expectations of women being much more appearance-based than men, maybe these past studies were influenced by the fact that the women always seemed more attractive because the women are putting more money and more care into their appearance because that's something that our society values more. But that it really has nothing to do with what they may or may not be trading.
Yeah, when I was looking into this this issue, I mean, the phenomenon they're looking at is called assortative mating, where you know how people sort themselves in terms of their mating preferences. And there's a lot of recent articles showing that income inequality is being driven by this to some degree. So they just very quickly, there was a study which showed that in 1960, there essentially wasn't much of a socioeconomic sorting effect on income inequality. That if you took a hypothetical population with random mating, like if you said if people sort of married each other completely at random, what would be the income inequality across households? And it was unchanged from what it actually was. On the index they were using between 0 and 1, it was 0.34. But in 2005, if you use 2005 data, the number rises, first of all, to 0.43. And then when you control for assortative mating, it drops back down to 0.34. In other words, there's a 0.09 increase in income inequality among households due to people who are better educated marrying other people who are better educated. You know, basically people marrying according to education level, which strongly predicts earning income. So it exaggerates the effect.
And it's worth noting something else that McClintock points out is that people who are at a higher socioeconomic status tended to be rated as more attractive. And like those two things go hand in hand because when you have more money, you are better able to take care of yourself, to eat healthier, to, you know, get lipo, to get your face.
Whatever.
You know, yeah, whatever it is. It's worth remembering that these two things are not mutually exclusive traits. You know, in fact, they are actually paired.
They're not independent variables.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Rebecca. So guys, I was flipping through the channels the other day. And I caught an episode of Wheel of Fortune. Have you guys watched this recently?
Oh, dear.
Yeah, little snippets here and there.
Was it a repeat or was it a recent episode?
No, like a recent episode.
Is Vanna White still turning letters?
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's that's exactly what caught my attention. So Pat Sajak and Vanna White still hosting it. So they went completely digital. You know, so they have they used to have like letters that you actually physically had to turn them. So Vanna White's job was to go down and turn the letters over that have been that these contestants.
Oh yeah, they don't need her anymore.
Yes, yeah, so exactly.
She's just her smartphone.
Waves her hand in front of it.
Yes, yeah, so she just walks by and touches the screen, and in order to make the lighted up you know squares show reveal their letters, she's completely superfluous. It just struck me
more so.
Yeah, that. Well, I mean, at least she was. She was actually turning the letters previously. I mean, she was doing something. And now, but so I couldn't help wondering, like, was there a conversation at some point among the TV executives where they said, okay, we're going to have a totally digital letter board. So Vanna White literally has nothing to do.
So, oh, yeah, absolutely. But you know, so what are we then gonna, the are conversation gonna, was like, oh, but the elderly are going to revolt if we get rid of Vanna White. Like, everybody loves Vanna White.
So what are we going to have her do? Well, let's just have her go by. We'll just have her touch the boxes. And
well, plus, Steve, she probably had a contract where they can't even make the show without her anymore.
Yeah, maybe. You know,
like, oh, those guys probably negotiated themselves into a sweet spot.
That's a good point. All right, well, Evan, do you have a Who's That Noisy for us?
Yeah, we're going to play last week's Who's That Noisy first for you. So here we go. I think you'll remember this one.
But my principal thoughts are that I should extend, if I can, that knowledge which I have on psychic matters and spread it as far as I can to those who have been less fortunate.
So, Evan, does this gentleman have a mustache?
Yeah, that's what we all want to know.
Yes, of course he did. Nice, big, bushy one. You know, the kind you could sweep the floor with.
Is it the Monopoly Man?
He kind of looks like the Monopoly Man in some of his photographs. Looks a little bit like William Howard Taft in some other ones. But in any case, that is Sir Arthur Ignatius Conan Doyle. I say.
Oh, that was Conan Doyle?
That was. Scottish physician and writer who is most noted for his fictional stories about the detective Sherlock Holmes. I say.
And for being super credulous.
Yeah, and very well known in skeptical circles. Fairies, psychics, all sorts of things having to do with spiritualism. And he was friends with Harry Houdini for a while, who obviously was the antithesis of all those things. And, although Houdini insisted that the spiritualists employed trickery, Doyle became convinced that Houdini had powers himself, right? Mm-hmm. And just didn't know it or wouldn't admit to it, his spiritual side.
And didn't their friendship end when Houdini wouldn't shut up about Doyle's wife? Isn't that what? Because his wife was a spiritualist.
Yeah, that's right. Who died in 1906. And that kind of, I think set A.C. Doyle off on a depression spiral of some sort. So he had to find a way to cope with that. And he found, through spiritualism, various forms and unfortunately all these pseudoscience and paranormal stuff, he took comfort.
Well, he was a spiritualist before his wife died.
They had a falling out over their disagreement on spiritualism.
Oh, they certainly had a falling out. Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody get it?
Oh, yes, several people, but there can be only one winner. And from the message boards, sguforums.com, this past week, Belgarath. Hey, our old friend from the message boards.
Belgarath.
Is this well week's done. Winner. Very, very well done. In the meantime, we have a brand new noisy for this week, which I will no longer delay and play for you at this moment. Here we go. Okay, so
a Claire de Lune,
extremely unpleasant.
You have to. It's obviously what the tune is. That's not what we're looking for, but we need to know what device specific or what specific. How should I put it? There's something very specific that creates that specific noise or that version of that tune. And you have to identify what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and send us your answer, WTN@theskepticsguide.org, or go ahead and join our forums and sguforums.com. That's where our message boards are. And as I say every week in some fashion, good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
All right, we got some emails here. Let's see how many we can get through. This one comes from John Dunham from Vermont. And John writes, "Dear Rogues, particularly Bob's." Bob, you got to pay attention. "I have been waiting for the past 2 weeks for you to discuss this news item about teleporting information. I thought to myself, what does this really mean? How likely is it to turn into something interesting sometime soon? Surely I can count on the Rogues to enlighten me. Alas, the item has not appeared on the SGU so far, and in a fog of disillusionment, I decided to send it in and presumably add it to the 10,000 other emails you have no doubt received suggesting you cover it. Anyway, I hope to hear your thoughts on it soon."
5 to 10 years.
5 to 10 years. Until next. We cover the item?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Well, sorry about your fog, John. Yeah, this is interesting. When you ask, what does this really mean? What I'll say is that what it doesn't mean, typically people make claims about entanglement that make unrealistic, not just unrealistic, but completely wrong claims. This doesn't mean instantaneous classical data transfer. It's only quantum data. You're not, you can't use this information to transfer, real things, say like email. You're not going to send an email with this. It's just quantum data. So Einstein's okay with this apparent faster than light travel. But what it does mean is that ultimately is that it's an important milestone for quantum computer networks and for creating privacy between these types of computers. So this is kind of a big deal for that kind of stuff. One of the main reasons is that in the past, teleporting information like this about the states of things like particles, like electrons. One of the hard things was that it would take lots and lots of tries before you'd have a successful experiment. And these guys can pretty much do it every time. Yeah, they're essentially doing it deterministically every time they do it. So that's pretty cool. John, you ask also how likely is it to turn into something interesting soon? Oh, geez, who the hell knows? I think eventually we'll make something of this. But in terms of the progress has been so slow compared to what I thought when I first heard about this stuff, you know, as a lot of this stuff is, it could be a while. It could be, who knows, 10, 15 years before we maybe see something really good. D-Wave has been in the news lately. They've been making claims for quantum computers existing right now in their prototypes and in their systems. And I remember we were kind of ragging on it a few years ago because there really was no solid evidence. And then there were some studies done that showed that it really was at least part of the time behaving like a quantum computer. But then an independent group very recently determined that it probably isn't a quantum computer. They made a test that made it more of an apples to apples test, because the test that said it was real was using software that was optimized for D-Wave, but not optimized for regular computers. So it really wasn't a fair comparison. So what they did is that they made it fair. They made it so that it was just as optimized for D-Wave as it was for regular computers, and showed really on average, no difference at all. So the most they'll say right now is that it's not, it's at least for that specific type of software, it's not behaving like a quantum computer. And I think it's going to make everyone very pessimistic about their claims in the future, unless they could really nail this down. But yeah, so that's the bottom line for this news item. It's really interesting. It could be a milestone for this type of quantum communications, qubits between within a quantum network, and privacy. So yeah, it could be big. And so we got to keep tracking this. It's going to be a while.
Yeah, but Bob, the reporting on this I found very disappointing. You know, a lot of the articles written about it were,
yeah,
first of all, they didn't make it clear the difference between quantum information and information.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them just said, you know, teleporting information between two quantum bits. So just for a quick, really quickie, yeah, background, when particles are entangled, quickie, that means that their quantum states that they have, they will be related to each other. Like, so if one is spin up, the other one will be spin down. And no matter how long they've been separated, if you measure one particle and figure out that it's spin up, you know the other one has to be spin down. So they seem to be communicating their quantum states even across vast distances. But as you say, this isn't really information the way we
it's
think
random,
about it.
Because it's random.
Yeah, it's not information that can be used to communicate. Like, you couldn't be sending a message using this. You couldn't be instantaneously sending your voice or sending any kind of message across millions of miles instantaneously, for example. So it doesn't violate Einstein's relativity. But I've read multiple reports all saying that researchers are trying to disprove Einstein. And that's not true, right, Bob? I mean, there's nothing about this that would contradict special or general relativity.
I don't know what articles you were reading. I wasn't reading anything quite as egregious as that. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's plenty of articles out there as well that really got it wrong.
Yeah.
But
they were at best misleading.
Mm-hmm.
All right, guys. Well, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Okay. Ready to mop up the mess we made last week? Yeah,
yeah, that was not good last week.
Right, here we go.
Throw out
these are going to be interesting. I think you'll find these interesting. No theme. Right. Item number one. Astronomers have detected the coolest white dwarf ever discovered, so cool that it is essentially an Earth-sized diamond. Item number two, new research suggests that after 3 to 4 repetitions of studying, further repetitions actually diminish memory recall. And item number three, research funded by the U.S. Naval Research Lab details a plan to reduce devastating tornadoes by building a series of giant walls throughout Tornado Alley. Rebecca, go first.
I have not heard any of these. Whoops.
My phone keeps going off. I'm trying to turn it off, and instead I turned on Siri. Siri's now going to record everything I say.
This is Rebecca. I accidentally turned Siri on. Let me see. New research.
Let me just read this out.
Oops.
Oh, I fell over.
I wish I was that brilliant. I feel like I've heard something about diamonds in space. No, wait. That was a Beatles song. It sounds familiar but I thought that was like a planet diamond, but a white dwarf being so cool that it's essentially a diamond. I'm trying to think of what stars are made of.
Hydrogen.
Baby dreams.
I mean, yeah, like hydrogen and helium, right? Not carbon. Aren't diamonds made of carbon?
Oh.
Is that a dumb thing to say?
You just do not listen to me ever, do you?
Correct. After 3 or 4 repetitions of studying, further repetitions diminish memory recall. That I believe, too, because I don't know if you're focusing too much on something. I don't know. That's a big maybe for me. I feel mostly because I feel that if you are focusing so hard on something that it actually becomes more difficult because you stress yourself out. But that if you study information once and then you walk away, it allows your brain to kind of process it and store it. And it makes it a bit better. But I don't know. Maybe that doesn't really impact repetition of studying so much. Building a series of giant walls throughout Tornado Alley. That's so ridiculous that I can't imagine Steve making it up. and it's just details a plan, not that the plan has actually gone into effect. I've heard that that there are hypotheses that the reason why tornadoes don't occur in large cities is because of the tall buildings not allowing a place for the tornadoes to form and move. But then I also heard that was debunked and that it's really just a matter of more open space being more likely to be hit by a tornado, and a city is a comparatively small area. And of course, tornadoes do hit cities every now and again. So I don't know. I'll go with the diamond one because I can't imagine how that is true. Although, but Bob did ask if I ever listened to him, so maybe he talked about this. I don't know. Whatever, I'm going with that one as the fiction. I have no idea.
Okay, Evan?
White dwarf. So cool, it's essentially an Earth-sized diamond. Well, we have talked about diamonds in space before on some planet like rains diamonds. And have we ever talked about diamonds in the context of stars, though? I don't know. Research suggests after three to four repetitions of studying, further repetitions actually diminish. This is plausible. No, I don't have a problem with this one. And then the U.S. Naval Research Lab details a plan to reduce the tornadoes by building a series of giant walls throughout Tornado Alley. Well, I'm inclined to believe this one's correct because even though there may be some practical problems with it, perhaps on paper it would actually work. I don't know. Repetition's one. I'll say that one's the fiction, but I have no confidence in my choice this week.
Okay, Bob.
White dwarfs are Earth-sized, and they can make carbon later in their lives. Let's go to the next one. 3 to 4 repetitions of studying. I don't know. This is so vague. I mean, how long are the bouts of studying? I mean, what about people that, you know, they specialize in a field that they go back to over and over and over? I mean, does that mean that their learning is somewhat diminished in a way, even though it's not identical to studying? Yeah, the walls. I mean, I could see how big are the walls? I don't think they're going to be Game of Thrones ice wall type structures, but they could, you know, they could be a certain size that's manageable that could disturb, you know, the tornadoes before they hit the ground enough. I mean, that's somewhat plausible. I'm going to go with studying. It's fiction.
And Jay?
The first one, sure. About the astronomers finding the diamond. I have no reason to doubt that. This one about the tornadoes, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, Bob, what you just said, like, they'd have to be really tall, I think, to have any effect on a tornado because, you know, a tornado can plow through dozens of houses and it laughs at that, you know? Like, this thing would have to be a ridiculously strong wall and it'd have to be really tall to break up a tornado. Like, you just gotta visualize it. The tornado would butt up against this wall and then dissipate because it can't move it. I don't know, man. There's something about the memory thing that I just can't believe that that's true. Like, everything about the way our memory works goes against that news item. You know, repetition builds a stronger connection in your brain. The pathway gets faster and more robust. Like, it has to be the fiction. So I'm going with that one as the fiction.
All right. So it's the guys against Rebecca tonight.
Yeah, they're probably going to win.
But you all agree... That research funded by the U.S. Naval Research Lab details a plan to reduce devastating tornadoes by building a series of giant walls throughout Tornado Alley. So you guys are imagining these massive walls running through the middle of the country, breaking up weather patterns.
Yeah.
To reduce tornadoes. Yes.
Yeah. I like it.
Did we screw up?
What?
When you put it that way.
What, is it like an allegory or something?
Well,
I'm sticking with this.
This one is science.
Yeah. Oh, so what is it? It's not a wall, is it?
It's like a wall. That's pretty much it. The guy wants to build massive walls. And yeah, what is it? 300 meters high? That's
300.
Like big.
Oh, what?
That's like Game of Thrones ice wall.
Yeah, that is impressive.
Well, I guess that makes sense, but like, talk about an eyesore. Yeah, let's
build gigantic
walls. I got a question.
First of all, this is America. We don't build in meters. Second, go ahead, Steve.
So the idea is not to break up tornadoes once they have formed, but to keep them from forming.
Yes.
Because essentially Tornado Alley in the United States exists because of clashing, you know, airstreams, which sets up the rolling motion, which turns into the tornado, right? Just to simplify it a little bit. So if you could disrupt these air currents, then that would prevent this scenario from happening. So
I mean, wouldn't they have to be thousands of feet tall though?
Well, he's saying 300 meters high would do it. And he said you could start, you know, by building one. He said a 1 mile wall would, at that height, would cost about $160 million.
That's all?
Yeah, given that tornadoes cause billions of dollars of damage every year. You know, it might in fact be cost effective.
But how do you know where to put it?
Well, you'd put it in like they have pretty good statistics on where tornadoes form. So you just put it in the highest risk areas.
Tornado Alley.
I have a better idea, Steve.
Yeah.
Take all that money and help relocate all those people.
Yeah. Move them out of their trailer parks.
Yeah. That's...
So he's saying,
nice.
We may need to build three great walls. The first one should be close to the northern boundary of the Tornado Alley, maybe in North Dakota. The second one should be in the middle, maybe in the middle of Oklahoma and going to the east. And the third one could be in the south of Texas and Louisiana.
I just don't like anything about that. It's
900
ridiculous.
Feet.
Yeah. Just imagine. Just even just a one mile wall that high. Just imagine that.
Jeez.
But hey, maybe we could build it out of that nano lattice structure.
Bob.
Bob, and it won't weigh much.
There you go.
Bob.
Yeah, baby.
Nano wall.
All right. Whatever. It's stupid and it's ugly, you know? Like, come on, get out of here. Unless they show movies on it.
Giant movie screen. No, Jay, it would be like one giant billboard. Can you imagine?
Yeah,
there'd
be advertising all over.
Like McDonald's.
Kilroy was here and all that crap.
All right, let's go back to number one. Astronomers have detected the coolest white dwarf ever discovered. So cool that it is essentially an Earth-sized diamond. Rebecca thinks this one is the fiction. The guys think this one is science.
Wait, you meant cool as in temperature?
Yeah.
Okay.
You didn't just mean awesome?
So awesome.
Dude.
So.
All right, come on.
Last week, we talked about the smallest star that could possibly exist. Mm-hmm. And now astronomers are saying they found perhaps the coolest star ever discovered. This one is science.
Yay, baby!
Boo.
It would be cool enough that the carbon would crystallize. And because of the pressure, et cetera, they say essentially it would be a giant Earth-sized diamond. Can you imagine?
That is phenomenal.
very, very dim, very, very cool, and it's roughly Earth-sized. It's 100 times fainter than any other white dwarf that we've seen.
Okay. 100.
So, Rebecca, when stars burn, they burn their hydrogen to helium, then they burn helium into heavier elements, and they keep going. And carbon has 6 protons, so that's it's a multiple of 2. So it,
yes,
when you start fusing the helium, you know, it's one, yeah. You make a lot of carbon. So see, as stars around this size that turn into white dwarfs, they have enough gravity to create a lot of carbon. Bigger stars can make heavier elements still, up to a maximum of iron. Once you get to iron, then it costs energy to fizz or fuse. And so that's, you know, you can't use iron as fuel, nuclear fuel. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the rest of the heavier, Steve, you got to finish it. You got to finish it. The rest of the heavier elements are created during the supernova.
Yeah, that's right. Everything above iron is made during a supernova. That's correct.
How cool that it keeps burning the ash from the previous phase to make something cool.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
All right. All this means that new research suggests that after 3 to 4 repetitions of studying, further repetitions actually diminish memory recall is the fiction.
Of course.
This is based, however, on a real item. Which was just too sketchy. I liked it, but it was too sketchy to make it a real one, so I just turned it into the fiction. The title of the press release says, UCI study finds that learning by repetition impairs recall of details. But I'm not sure that that's what the research really means. What they found was that when you learn through, they had, you know, the subjects learn information through repetition, that it improved their recall for details, but their rate, so they were looking at a photograph, right? The rate at which they identified false photographs as real went up. So what does that mean? I don't think that necessarily means I couldn't make entire sense of it, which is why I didn't feel comfortable using it as a science. So what they write is, the details of a memory become more subjective the more they're recalled and can compete with bits of other similar memories. The scientists hypothesize that this may even lead to false memories akin to a brain version of the telephone game. So that kind of makes sense. So every time you repeat something, you're recalling it, and every time you recall a memory, that you can rewrite it, and this might cause the details to drift and to, you actually start to get more false memories get woven in there, and that could degrade the detail of the memory. But at the same time, the subjects got better at identifying the picture that they were supposed to be studying. So I don't know that you could make a clean interpretation of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It increased factual recall, but hindered their ability to reject imposter pictures. So what does that mean? I don't know. Interesting. But I twisted it to be the fiction. So the more you study it, I mean, it's going to improve your overall memory. They were still able to recall things better. Just maybe some fake information was working its way in there. Okay.
Yeah.
Good job, guys.
Thank you.
Except for me.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Next week, guys.
Next time.
That's true.
The gendered guys. Yeah. All right. So, Jay, you got a quote for us?
I have a quote sent in from a listener named Karen. She's from Sydney, Australia, lawyer and risk audit compliance coordinator. And Karen, maybe we'll be seeing you at a conference at some point in the near future. The quote author is Carl Sagan, and the quote is, "The significance of our lives and our fragile planet is then determined only by our own wisdom and courage. We are the custodians of life's meaning. We long for a parent to care for us, to forgive us our errors, to save us from our childish mistakes, but knowledge is preferable to ignorance. Better by far to embrace the hard truth than a reassuring fable. If we crave some cosmic purpose, then let us find ourselves a worthy goal." Carl Sagan!
I do like that quote. That's exactly my philosophy as well. The universe is meaningless, so we have to make our own meaning. It's all subjective anyway. And any meaning you can hope to have, if you put it in, you could always put it into a larger perspective that makes it essentially diminished down to nothingness. So you determine your own meaning. So you might as well make it something that's worthwhile and practical, et cetera. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree more.
And that's all better than a reassuring fable. I like the way he puts that. Just, you know, the other part of this, is that part of growing up, at least for me, was growing into this realization that there essentially are no adults in the universe. You know what I mean? It's like everybody is in the same boat. There are no magical people out there who really totally control things. This is why I think conspiracy theories always strike me as so profoundly naive. Nobody's in that much control. We're all muddling through. That's why everyone thinks like their company, their institution is dysfunctional. You know what I mean? Yeah, they all are. I don't know anybody anywhere who is part of a large organization who doesn't think it's dysfunctional to some degree. It's only a matter of how much. You know what I mean? It's almost like, it's almost as if they get there, you know, taking this, he's talking about there's no God looking over us. You know, we're on our own. So let's make it work. But it's even a little bit more. I would go even further to say, you know, it's almost as if there are no like uber competent people who are in total control either. Do you guys feel that? Do you guys feel that way, or is it just me?
No, of course. I mean, it's as you become an adult, you most of us, I hope, become aware of the fact that, you know, you are it. You know, you are the highest authority to yourself. And then eventually you realize that the government doesn't know what the hell they're doing, and that, you know, most adults running businesses don't know what the hell they're doing, and everyone's just making the best guesses that they can.
Not to diminish the role of expertise and experience, it's all, and professionalism, it's all real, but it's still all flawed people doing their best. And I think in general, you know, we're a little bit overwhelmed by the reality, you know.
Yeah, our modern lives are very complicated as well, and we can only be good at so many different things, you know.
Yeah, Rebecca can't handle Siri, apparently.
Shut up.
Not
Shut
yet.
Up.
In a way, it raises the stakes, though, on successes, right? Like, when I see a wonderful movie or hear an incredibly, you know, well-played and written song, or you know, read the latest research on something I find fascinating, you know, in spite of the fact that we're so complicated and screwed up and everything, you know, we could still make these amazing achievements that are so freaking worth it. Like, it just makes life so worth it to experience those things.
Exactly. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You're welcome,
thank Steve.
Steve.
Thank you,
Thank Steve. You,
Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.